The first scripture this morning from Psalm 146, starting with verse 5. Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea and everything in them. He remains faithful forever. He upholds the cause of the oppressed and gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the foreigner and sustains the fatherless and the widow, but he frustrates the way of the wicked. The Lord reigns forever, your God, O Zion, for all generations. Praise the Lord.
James 5. 7 to 10. Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord.
Morning. So, Advent 3. Traditionally, this is the week that the joy candle will be lit. And who's more joyful than all these children that were just up here? It's so readily accessible, the joy that they have. I wish I had that much joy. Somehow the cares of life can wear on you, and that joy can be hard to get. But last night there was joy in our house as we were setting up our Christmas tree. And the joy is palpable as we're decorating this thing. But the joy can be dashed rather quickly, because who gets to put the star up? Very important. And we're going to have to get a better system for who gets to do it, because I can't remember who did it last year. And they claim that they know who did it last year. And who gets to do it this year is very important. And so, anyway, I had this in my mind because I thought, I wonder how much joy was when putting that star up there. That looks kind of a tricky, precarious thing to do. And maybe I can have my kids come and help next time they put that up. That looks like a joyful thing to put up. So, it's funny that this week we're thinking about joy. Well, joy would be the theme, but as you heard from the call to worship, we're also thinking about fear. Now, how does fear connect with joy? They seem opposite to each other in a way. Somehow, the drudgery of life and even the pain that we can experience can make joy hard to access. Let me share a story. I have felt pain. I've experienced intense pain before. For example, one time I had the wind knocked out of me, and I got a couple of cracked ribs during an intensely competitive pickup football game. And if you've ever had the wind knocked out of you, it is dreadful. It's a pain that makes you want to twist out of your body or just wiggle away from that point of agony, if possible. Kind of like a bug struggling to get out from under a boot that hasn't quite settled in on it with its full weight. But this pain that I experienced was different. This moment, in June of 2004, my 23-year-old body, mostly invincible, knew that something was wrong. You know all those terrible scenarios and happenings and tragedies that can't be predicted, but happen to others. They torment others and grieve others, always others. But they never happen to you, of course. I feared that this may have been one of those lightning strikes. I knew that this pain wasn't something that I was just going to walk off and laugh about. So after my girlfriend, the farm girl, impressively lifted that four-wheeler off of me, I then intended to stand up and show my manly tolerance of pain, given time and space, and my youthful resilience would recover and could go about my business again, but not this time. This time, Beth ran off for help. For a phone, for something, someone who could possibly assess the damage and make reparations. But time, I feared, was going to be swifter than her return. I wondered as I laid there, waiting. I wondered if I was being poisoned by the very organs that support my life, that I was being fouled by the waste that they typically purify away from me. Maybe I was bleeding, and my life was draining away from me, of all places within me. These kind of questions and others were swirling around in my mind, but the ones of meaning began to rise to the top. If I was minutes from checking out and meeting my maker, what would that mean? It's a strange thought for a 23-year-old invincible person. Now, if I was looking at this moment objectively and I could place when and where I'm going to pass on and die, I think that if I'd have looked at this particular moment, I'd have thought that my failure to survive, at least to make it to my wedding night before kicking the bucket, would be a major disappointment. However, it wasn't my unfulfilled dreams, but my secrets and my regrets and my sins and my failures that were coming to mind. What does God think of me right now? These fears were at the top of my thoughts. Does the black outweigh the red in my ledger? And in that dreadful fear, I bargained and begged with God like a child. I vowed extraordinary things, just like Hannah offered a child back to God if he would give one. I said, God, if you give me my life, if you allow me to have my life, I will get it right. I will lead others to you like I know you've called me to. I will be righteous and faithful and obedient. And even now, divulging this to you feels shameful to admit. It's amazing how things get prioritized when you're looking squarely in the face of your own mortality. And the weight that I experienced in that moment, the weight of either losing consciousness or for Beth to get back, that weight was more agonizing than that four-wheeler landing squarely on my abdomen and bursting the fully saturated bladder within it. Now, a lot of time has passed since then, and a lot of retellings of this story, answering questions about making the news, getting a helicopter ride, jokes about never letting him ride a four-wheeler ever again, jokes about this incredulous disbelief that people had that my lovely girlfriend and I had chosen to be in such a secluded place to pick raspberries. Sure you were. Excuse me while me and my girlfriend go off in the woods to pick raspberries. These things have colored my telling of this story. And even my memory of this traumatic event has changed to sort of a dismissive or inconsequential flavor, a less impactful recollection. I came out of this experience with a great big scar that's got to be explained when I go to the beach. Lots of bills that have long since been paid off. And some funny to pass on stories, good stories for social gatherings. And maybe the truth is closer to this perspective. But when I really stop and let my mind go back, I remember the dreadful fear of that weight. I knew she was coming back, but would she get here before my body failed? There was a promise that I had no reason to doubt, but could I make it until the promise was fulfilled? What does that mean? Waiting is a funny thing. Beth and I both describe ourselves as doers. If any of you have observed the schedule that we keep, we are task-oriented. And when life serves up the regular and unavoidable and completely expected verb of wait, we typically put on our spiritually mature parent face when in mixed company. But our children are far more accurate in reflecting our actual address. Our residence is within impatience. And our lack of charity for obstacles or hindrances and the like is every bit as selfish and whiny as they so skillfully communicate. I can't imagine choosing to wait as a general rule. With a few exceptions, like waiting. Just hold on, wait a few more moments for that 8-point to move forward just a little more past that big tree so that I can get that open kill shot. But waiting is hard. I can remember being told, honestly, has anybody ever heard this? Don't ever pray for patience. Okay, don't do it. Because if you start praying for patience, God might actually start making you wait a little more. And then you feel all the impatience that you have within you. Having to wait is normal. And supposedly, it improves us. I guess. Like an oak barrel aids in wine aging. So waiting can mature us, depending on what you're waiting on. But waiting in line at the DMV is not the same as waiting for your wife to give birth. Waiting for a bill to show up in the mail is not the same as waiting for a letter of acceptance to college. Waiting for a tooth to fall out is not the same as waiting for the results of your biopsy. Waiting has many flavors and intensities. And saying, I can't wait for Jesus to come back, can be said the same way as saying, I can't wait for Christmas. Or it can be said like, I can't wait for this to be over. Maybe one person is anticipating rewards and celebration or the ecstasy of being in the Lord's presence, but another simply craves relief or justice. Waiting has very different notes when colored with fear and pain. And that sort of waiting is also normal. It certainly was normal in the days that Jesus first showed up on this terrestrial sphere. The waiting the world experienced in those days, the groaning, the longing that we sing about when we sing, O come, O come, Emmanuel. This is oh so familiar again in these days as we wait again for Jesus to once again set foot on earth. And you heard the scriptures read in Psalms and James. We know God is faithful and upholds the oppressed. He reigns forever and for all generations. And while we're waiting on him, we're not supposed to be in a foul mood or be mean to each other. We have to set an example. His return is almost here, so buck up and show the world how hopeful we are. But our senses and our own living experience tell us that life tends to fade into decay and anarchy. The news rarely tells of upward trends that lift our spirits. It can seem like depravity, cruelty, decay, and corruption. These all drag on and on and on while we are waiting. Our 2,000 plus years of waiting. John the Baptist, if you're not aware of him, cousin of Jesus, lived at the exact same time of him, one of the last great prophets. He had the hand of God on him, and everyone knew it, especially him, because his birth followed an angelic announcement, and it fulfilled deeply held and revered prophecy. And can you imagine the expectations on him from others, or even on himself? He knew his role, he knew his calling, and he walked in it. He called for repentance, to prepare the way for the Lord, to get right with God. And he did it loud and long and to whomever needed to hear it, including Herod. And what a great place it is to be God's anointed one, to be in God's favor. When God's hand is on you and his favor rests on you mightily, it translates into power and wealth and influence and comfort and certainty, right? John the Baptist is first string, all-pro, Hall of Fame prophet material. He was the setup man for the greatest closer ever in the universe. Certainly, he's going to have some protection, some insulation, some security. God's going to take care of him. He's going to have some trappings, right? For his pedigree, for his faithfulness, his raw talent. He's going to have a legendary success story, right? Yeah. John knew he had a great call and purpose, and he didn't carry himself with pride. He did it right. And he ended up in prison. And he probably was okay with that at first, because he laid it all out for the cause of Christ. But while he waits in prison, as far as he can tell, Jesus has changed nothing. Prophecy said that the Messiah is going to bring order and joy and uphold the oppressed and lay the proud low, make the crooked lanes straight. Everything before and during John's life was aimed at setting up Jesus for his awesome renewing of this stinking, tortured, and tear-stained world. And John sat and waited in prison, and nothing changed. You know, it was probably a given as these two cousins were growing up that they had a sense of the grand role that they were supposed to play in this epic story. Can you imagine the internal workings in John, always faithful John, to finally be disillusioned enough to ask Jesus, "Are you really the Messiah?" He could have been saying, "Is my life often been for nothing?" In Matthew chapter 11, verse 2, you can turn there if you like. It says, "When John was in prison, he heard about the deeds of the Messiah. He sent his disciples to ask him, 'Are you the one who's to come, or should we expect someone else?' And Jesus replied, 'Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me.'" When doubts were trickling into John's mind as he waited, fear found a place to really color his wait. Waiting can turn to despair and dread if you really cook it well. And dear Lord, our world is full of it. Refugees, sex trafficking, drug addiction, poverty, that's just for starters in Franklin County. Can you imagine the dread felt by a victim of repeated abuse? I know some of you can. Does the state of our own backyard not give us doubt of the sovereignty of our Lord? And if John the Baptist had doubts while Christ walked on the earth, then we shouldn't beat ourselves up or others up for experiencing doubt or fear or pain or suffering in the wait for Christ's deliverance. Do you think we can give ourselves permission to feel deeply? Because God does. Shouldn't we be expecting suffering in service of a crucified Lord? Last week, Connie spoke about a day that is to come. It's been 2,000 years. Is it so unbelievable to entertain thoughts that after all this time, maybe the day never will come? Christ responded to John's call, to his question, by calling for testimony. He told the disciples, "Tell them what you've seen. What do you think?" From their relationship with him, he said, "Who am I to you?" These questions ring with meaning to those of us who are waiting in the church today to address fear and doubt and give comfort. Tell them. Tell them what you've seen. Tell them who I am out of our relationship. Tell them our waiting can focus not only on facts or deeds, but love, because we know him. The fact that Jesus fulfilled hundreds of prophecies given for centuries. In written and oral tradition, and his virgin birth was foretold. These are facts. Many prophecies spoke of his impeccable character. They spoke of his divine position and of him administering justice to the least valuable in our eyes. Facts. Deeds. What did he do? He healed. He performed countless miracles. He broke the power of sin and death. And by his resurrection, all humanity has been freely given a clean slate and an opportunity at an eternally blissful life in the presence of the Father. Facts and deeds. The facts say he's done plenty to prove himself. And given his track record, we can look forward in faith and hope that he will in fact come again, as he said, and establish his glorious kingdom, no matter how long we have to wait. But those facts, those deeds, they aren't as valuable as the ones who witnessed them. Those who have tasted and seen. You see, it's not laying out a case with information that compels the broken nearly as much as our love of the Master. His love compels far more than what he can do for us. And he's done so much. 1 John 4:18 says, "Perfect love casts out fear." If you've heard his voice, felt his touch, read his words, the doubts are far less loud. The fear is not so cold as his loving warmth. His loving kindness is better than this dreadful life. His love draws us to know him. Do you know him? Jesus said that he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I too will love him and will show myself to him. To love him is to know him, is to love him. When you know your faith and hope is not on his accomplishments, but on him. Our faith is not in, it's not in our understanding of apologetics or theological order, even though they are invaluable. The greatest commandment is not be thoroughly versed. Sorry, I lost my place. Be thoroughly versed in all proper behaviors and right thought, as I've instructed you. That's not the most important commandment. The most important commandment is to love him with everything you can muster. Because love makes the wait worth it. Love turns our dread into anticipation. Love puts the rejoice right smack dab in the middle of sorrow. Loving Jesus means that you know that you know that though the sorrow may last for the night, joy will come in the morning because that's who he is. For you, today, December 2019, what are you waiting for? And how are you waiting? I find that many days I'm just waiting to get past the latest obstacle and hoping for tomorrow to be better. That might be pretty neutral for some whose existence is unbearable, or some who have the gift or the curse of seeing the ugliness that's out there. But I have some good news. Jesus is with us in our hurt. Jesus sees what you see. And that's why he puts scriptures like Isaiah 35 in the Bible, which we'll be hearing in just a moment. He came once, as was foretold. He will come again, like he said. And he wants us to know, he wants you to know that he loves you. And he hopes that you'll love him and know him. Because he can be known. And one of the best parts of being in community is that you can know him by hearing others talk about him and what he's done. Jesus said, "Tell them what you saw." I challenge everyone here as a matter of Let's see what will happen if, all right? Let's see what will happen if each one of us intentionally tells someone, inside or outside of the church, doesn't matter, something about what Jesus has shown you, what he's meant to you, what he has worked in you. Talk about how you relate to him. How about once a week? Let's say for a month, maybe. I can't make you do this, but maybe you can take a challenge, personal, and even if this body doesn't embrace it entirely, what would happen if you tried it? Well, look, I just see a community of cows doing everything together all the time, and I figured a community of believers would try to do something together too. Especially one that needs to practice our lofty goal of inviting others into the way of Jesus. Let's talk about what he means to us. Talk about what he means to me. Talk about what he means to you. Just once a week. Because whose spirit can be lifted by that? Whose waiting can turn from despair to hope just from hearing your take on who Jesus is to you? Can we bring a little, maybe just a little, peace on earth by sharing this love with each other and others? Man, hearing about Jesus, hearing about him is a massive faith builder, but talking about it takes it on a new level of reality. Words get you out of your head. Ask Peter if saying who Jesus is to you is a small matter. He who denied him 3 times. If we never say the words, is it the same as denying him? We love to say that actions speak louder than words, but words can put order to our thoughts so that we aren't simply going through the motions. And in this season of Advent and Christmas, when the messages that are just so commonplace in our culture are frivolous and without meaning, for us to speak of our love of Christ to someone, wow, what would the meaning be there? We know that so much is distracting. So much of our culture is distracting from distraction and fear and loneliness that everybody feels inside. The stuff that's floating around with Christmas, all the hubbub and the shopping and the stuff. This stuff is on top and underneath. There's a whole lot of loneliness out there. But if we talk about what Jesus means to us, just maybe we could be fulfilling the angelic proclamation of peace on earth that much sooner.
Isaiah 35. The desert and the parched lands will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. The glory of Lebanon will be given to it. The splendor of Carmel and Sharon. They will see the glory of the Lord, the splendor of our God. Strengthen the feeble hands. Steady the knees that give way. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong and do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The burning sands will become a pool, the thirsty ground bubbling springs. In the haunts where jackals once lay, grass and reeds and papyrus will grow. And a highway will be there. It will be called the Way of Holiness. It will be for those who walk on that way. The unclean will not journey on it. Wicked fools will not go about on it. No lion will be there, nor any ravenous beast. They will not be found there. But only the redeemed will walk there, and those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away.